Bonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. I think that we're live. Jules told me that we're live. Right before the show, I had Donna Gilmore on the air, and our internet got disconnected, like, boom, right at 8 o'clock. So I apologize for that. So let me see if I can give Donna another call and add her in now. So let's try this. I know that she's waiting. We have a lot to talk about. So hopefully this will work and she'll be at the other end. It's been a few minutes. So thank you for joining us. Today is November 7th, 2017. It's now 8:04 in the morning. Let's see if this phone call goes through. Come on, Donna.
Hi.
Hi, Donna. We're on the air. The internet worked right after our bumper, so we were right on.
Okay, that's great.
Well, thanks for joining us. And to our listeners, this is Donna Gilmore with SanOnofreSafety.org. She's a citizen activist who basically has uncovered and is in the process of uncovering a multitude of malfeasance, that's what I call it, on behalf of the nuclear industry. So, Donna, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been very busy since I last spoke to you. I was up at the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. This is a state entity. It has three members. One is appointed by the governor. One is appointed by the attorney general. And one is appointed by the California Energy Commission chairman. It's quite different than the Santa Free, what they call community engagement panel here. The Santa Onofre one is totally run by the utility, so the California Edison, and it's more of just a propaganda piece that's pretty frustrating to deal with. The one at Diablo Canyon, near Diablo Canyon in San Luis Obispo, there are three nuclear engineers, and they actually seem to be interested in real issues. I was invited by Peter Lamb, one of the members, to make a presentation to this committee, which I did October 19th, and that is available online.
I think I've seen that. Yeah, that was really great, actually.
Yeah, PG&E was there, and they also webcast these meetings, but PG&E was there. And they made a number of comments that weren't true. So it was actually cathartic to be able to, you know, challenge them and provide the truth. For example, EPRI, which is a utilities lab that the NRC and other people use also, Electric Power Research Institute, I think is what that stands for. They were hired to check a couple of Diablo Canyon canisters to see if moist salt could be on the thin wall, half inch thick stainless steel canister, because the NRC knows that this could trigger those canisters to start cracking. Stainless steel has a unique property. Once it cracks, the crack will grow on its own through the wall of the container in about 16 years, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But they had no idea if the canisters would be susceptible, if there would be enough moisture, because the canisters are hot, if there would be enough moisture to land on the container, and if there would be salt there to kind of dissolve it. They call it deliquesce on the container. Well, guess what? A two-year-old canister, they only checked two, and they only checked the part they could reach through the air vents on this concrete cast that the thin wall canisters are stored in. They have air vents to cool the fuel in the thin wall canister. But so they did what they could by putting something robotic through the air vents to scrape some particles off the surface of the canister. They never clean these things. It's all that just sits there, and anything that comes in through the air fence pretty much stays there unless it gets blown out. And they found salt, and they found a low enough temperature for moisture to stay on the canister. So this is a two-year-old canister.
Do they have no procedure for cleaning it?
No.
Or maintaining it? They just put the stuff in there and never work to maintain the integrity of the canister?
It's a bad design. It's a poor design. It was never designed to be inspected.
But that even makes it more urgent to make an effort to maintain it if it's a bad design.
One would think. Initially the NRC thought it would be 30 years before a crack could start. At least that's what they said in a July and an August 2014 meeting when I asked questions about this. They said the canisters would be so hot, no moisture could stay on the surface of the canister to melt any salt that might be there. There's other things that can cause these things to crack, but they were focused on, basically moist salt air from the ocean, which we have plenty of along the Pacific coast by Diablo and San Onofre. And I had asked about, I had found out through my research that EPRI was checking some Diablo Canyon canisters, but I hadn't seen any reports on it. I had found some information on my own that had been leaked by the Department of Energy in another report, and they claimed they had no information. So anyway, EPRI waited forever to finally do a report on Diablo Canyon, and in that they admit they found low enough temperatures on a two-year-old canister for moisture to stay on the surface, and they found salts. They found corrosive magnesium chloride salt. You know, I mean, it's right by the ocean, and you got plenty of fog, and yeah, this was high burner fuel, so they actually expected that the canister would be hotter than it really was. So,
What year was this that they found this?
Oh my gosh, that's a good. Okay, let's see. Inspection EPRI. They published it in August of 2016. I didn't even know this report was out. So there was no announcement or anything. I forget how I ended up finding this, but I did read it before I went to this Diablo Canyon meeting, and PG&E said, "Oh well, this EPRI report is out. And it shows that there's no problem with the Diablo Canyon canisters. You know, there's not enough salt to be a problem." And I read the report. I said, "That's not true. The report tried to downplay it, the risk. But if you read the data in the report, it's very clear that the risk is there." And I also told them that in 2014, I was asked to speak at NRC's annual waste conference, and while I was there, there was a person from EPRI making a presentation about this inspection at Diablo and a few other places. And I asked the EPRI person, I said, "Given that you have limited access to the thin wall canister, because it has to stay inside this concrete overpack or it would kill you, and they had to try and go through the air vents." I said, "What percent were you actually able to sample for corrosive particles and sample the temperature? Because that's about all they could do. They have no way to inspect the canisters for cracks." And he said about 10%. So they were only able to look at about, 10% of this. And then there was also some problems with, even their data and handling and all that. Anyway, so it was a very limited look for variables. It was not an inspection, because they have no way to inspect any of these canisters. They weren't designed. We're talking about just on the outside, let alone the inside. So anyway, I said in that Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee meeting that wasn't true, that the evidence was in that report that it's vulnerable to cracking. So that was one issue. And then PG&E said that the reason they didn't choose thick wall casts, now the thin wall, just to back up since some people may be new here, the thin wall canisters used in most of the United States, but not very many places in the rest of the world, they're mostly half-inch thick stainless steel canisters that only partially protect from radiation, so must be enclosed in some type of a concrete, normally a concrete overpack, either a horizontal or vertical system, and it normally has air vents because the canister needs to be kept cool because of the hot fuel. And so you can't inspect them. They're vulnerable to premature cracking. They and the utilities have no plan in place to find or repair cracks, and no way to monitor to prevent leaks.
Well, not only that, they vent. I was stunned to discover in our last conversation they vent at least carbon-14 24 hours a day from the time they're placed on site.
Yeah, the thin canister can't hold all the radionuclides, and the concrete is meant to block gamma and neutrons, but various, I don't have a full list of the radionuclides. They don't measure those. Dennis Nelson, he's a biochemist. He was at that same NRC meeting I was at in 2014, and he asked, you know, well, how much carbon-14 is coming out of these? Oh, not very much. Well, what is it? Well, we don't measure it. Why don't you measure it? Oh, it wouldn't be enough to matter. You know, that's the kind of answer he got.
Wow. The half-life of carbon-14 is 5,730 years. So we've had a cumulative...
Basically forever. Yeah. So it's, you know, one of many crazy things. So what I want, okay, so let me just get back to this part for people that just get the background out of the way. So we have a situation where they've got thousands, over a couple of thousand of these in the United States. Most of them are less than 10 years old. Some have finally reached a little over 20 years. They have no idea if they're cracked, how many cracks, how deep the cracks are, when they're going to leak. No plan to deal with leaks. No plan to monitor. I mean, they don't even have to monitor. The only monitoring they have to do for leaks is once every 3 months, somebody has to walk around with a monitor on a stick and check the radiation levels. That's it. And I made this statement at this Diablo Canyon Safety Committee meeting, and the three engineers who've been meeting with PG&E for decades had no idea that this was true. They were kind of in disbelief. So they called PG&E back up to the podium and said, is this true, what Don said? And he tried to, you know, wiggle around it, but then he finally admitted, yeah, that's true. You know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, you know, all my evidence is evidence that they would use, that PG&E would use, that the NRC uses, that DOE would use. I mean, the type of evidence that I have is indisputable. So the nuclear industry and the NRC and utilities, they have a hard time countering my information. I mean, I don't put anything out that's opinion pieces and nothing that isn't sourced by what would be considered a credible document by them and most others. So I highly recommend that approach with people. And on San Onofre Safety, I've basically done all the work for you and done all the research. I've got all the links, the references, sample handouts, you know, action items, everything to get the word out and try and change the way we're storing our nuclear waste in this country before these canisters start leaking and some may potentially explode due to this high burn up fuel they're using now, which burns longer in the reactor, so it makes them more money. But it's over twice as thermally hot and over twice as radioactive and unstable in storage and transport. It can actually damage the fuel rods. They call it cladding, but it's fuel rods, and it can actually damage the uranium pellets, change the structure of it. And it develops hydrides, which basically, if you get oxygen exposure, you can have hydrogen gas, which can cause explosions. So, you know, there's a few more variables than that, but, you know, that's the gist of what we're facing. And each canister contains about...
I have a question to ask you. All this work, you've been very active, I mean, seriously heroic in uncovering all of this about the waste and how and you really helped educate a lot of the people who make decisions. My question is, have we gotten our Congress? I mean, the information is there. Like, I faxed your information on these canisters and on HR 3053 to all of the Oregon representatives. And I thought I had gotten three of them to change their minds, but I didn't. I actually went back and looked. I had the three that the one that contacted me has always voted against anything on this waste. But the question is, how do we get stronger? How do we get the people who are the decision makers to really take a hand and look at these institutions and say how we've been doing it is different than how we've always been doing it? and I have to call well, back.
Go ahead.
What did you just say? I think we lost the radio station, but hold on, let me double check. Okay. No, I think we're here.
Okay. All right.
You're still on.
Well, you know, we obviously haven't gotten to the right people, to enough people, and we have others that are countering the information that we have. There's a lot of propaganda out there, and I learned even, you know, the former chairman of the NRC and top people at the Department of Energy were not even aware of these cracking issues. We have a new administration now, so, you know, not that it would matter. I mean, even under Democrat or Republican, we've had this problem happening. So we need more outreach. We could use some better media attention. We could use somebody like John Oliver to get the word out.
John Oliver did try to get the word out. You saw what he did at the beginning of summer, right? That was actually pretty strong.
It wasn't. Because it played right into what the nuclear industry wants to do. John Oliver, he did a good job of explaining part of the problem. He did a really good job there. He's such an effective communicator, and he's on the right side. But his recommendation, was, you know, to open Yucca Mountain. It was to build Yucca Mountain and to move the waste at the current locations and put it somewhere else, you know, which is exactly what the nuclear industry wanted. So, but I think John Oliver got played. But it's hard to get the truth out. I mean, he didn't contact me. I don't know who he got his information from. So that can be part of the problem, who he's getting his information from. Maybe he's getting it from Union of Concerned Scientists. They know about these cracking canisters, but they are just hoping that somebody's going to magically solve this problem, you know. So, that's one of the challenges. That's what I was encouraged about at this Diablo Canyon meeting is you have three state-appointed members that report directly to Jerry Brown and the Governor Brown, the Attorney General, and the California Energy Commission Chairman Weissmuller, who is actually a nuclear engineer. And if I can convince these three members that are considered the key advisors to California state government, that's going to be a move in the right direction, you know.
Good luck to you if you can convince a nuclear engineer.
Well, I understand that, but let me share with you. I went to Sacramento and made a presentation to this nuclear workshop, Chairman Weissmuller, California Energy Commission. And Peter Lamb, who is one of the members of the Diablo Canyon Safety Committee, he was there. He made a presentation. I made a presentation. And after my presentation, where I talked about these issues, Chairman Weissmuller says to Peter Lamb, well, I'm sure you're going to want to talk to Donna after this session. You know, she's bringing up some significant information here, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to Peter after, and he said, well, you should come and speak at our Diablo Canyon committee meeting. You know, I'll give you as much time as you need, he said. Okay, so I thought, you know, I kind of thought maybe he was just blowing me off or something. But anyway, so I finally did it, and they gave me all the time pretty much that I needed. And
nice.
Peter Lamb was there. Peter Lamb gave me a great introduction. He called me instrumental and getting public awareness about the stress corrosion cracking issue. And then we have this on video, and he said this at the meeting. Peter Lamb said this. he said, I would like to offer, I'm quoting him here, I would like to offer a disclosure. 20 years ago, I served as a federal administrative judge sitting on a licensing board, approved the dry cask storage system here at Diablo Canyon. At that time, the chloride stress-induced corrosion cracking was not known to the licensee, that would be PG&E, was not known to the licensing board, was not known to Holtec. So this is an evolving, entirely new development. I would like to make that disclosure because Mr. Gerald Strickland served as a licensing manager during the judiciary hearing here in San Luis Obispo. Gerald Strickland is the PG&E, is with PG&E. He's the one that was saying all these things in his presentation that were not true. And now Peter Lamb was very tactful here and giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Giving them an out as to why they didn't know.
Yeah, giving them a face-saving out, you know, and assuming, of course, if they knew, they would have told him type of thing. So that was very politically
When was this
smart.
Statement made, though? I have
this
to say.
October 19th of this year. Now, Peter Lamb, I think Diablo started loading canisters in 2006. So Peter Lamb was not only the NRC judge that approved the, the license was challenged, the dry source license was challenged, I think by Mothers of Peace, I don't know if anybody else. And so this went to an appeal process that the NRC has. And so he not only was the judge that approved that license, the NRC license for that storage facility, Diablo, he had disclosed at the nuclear workshop, California Education Nuclear Workshop that I'd been at previously, and he disclosed that he was the judge that had approved the private storage facility in Utah. That was to be the first consolidated interim storage facility in the United States. And the license was approved due to pushback from the state. They were never able to use it. There are various reasons. That's a whole other story. But the nuclear industry and maybe the NRC and a lot of people are looking at that license for a consolidated interim storage facility in Utah called Private Storage Facility. They're using that as a template that, hey, we had one approved already by the NRC. So let's use that same template and get more. It was a bad decision, not just about the fact they were using these thin wall canisters, but you know that's another story. But the fact that the judge is coming out and basically saying that his decision, you know, is up for question because you know he did not know about these, these cracking issues is significant. So we have that.
Well, I think also what's significant is that it's taken this long. Like, as soon as you started talking about this information, that person kind of had a responsibility to come forward and say, hey, I really didn't know about this. What can we do about it? And he ought to have been on the right side of this from the get.
Yeah.
A decision maker. So to me, saying, oh, well, I didn't know a long time ago. How long have you been after this? That's why I asked you, when did this happen? Because You didn't, as you say, you don't use sort of internet sources and fly-by-night sources, so to speak, you know, questionable sources.
No. You use
their information from government agencies and from the actual manufacturer. And it's actually really known facts that everybody could have known from the get-go had they read the manufacturer's material.
The manufacturer, you know, Holtec does not tell you this. You do not want to get your information from the manufacturer. They are not the honest folks here. They will make misleading statements. They parse their words very carefully, but you know, my BS meter apparently is higher than a lot of other people's.
What about where did you get it from?
I first learned about this July 14th, 2014. Huh. All right, I remember the date. And then they had a follow-up meeting August 5th, 2014. And I was on the phone. You can call into any NRC has meetings every day. They have a calendar right on their homepage, nrc.gov. You can, you know, look and see what's up. If it's something you're interested in, you can get a call-in number, listen in, ask questions. You know, so most people aren't going to want to bother with that, and maybe don't.
Well, I have to work or I'm in school. Every time one of those calendar things, it's just not. It's impossible for me to call in.
Yeah, no, I mean, no, most people can't do it. You know, I'm supposed to be retired, so I do have more time, and I'm strongly motivated because I live here.
Yeah.
And nobody else is really, you know, taking the lead on this issue, and I've had to educate people that with good intentions on our side of safety concerns, we're totally not aware of these issues. Okay, well, it's not something they advertise, but if you know by listening in, and I was asked by someone to. Hey, this might be an important meeting. Could I get a volunteer to listen in? So that's how that started. And that's where I learned that they have discovered these things can crack from salt air. Gee, who would have thought? Metal and salt air, right? And what I didn't know about the properties of stainless steel, which I've since learned a lot about, is once a crack starts in stainless steel, it has a unique granular structure that cracks grow on their own all the way through the wall, you know, and they said it would take about 16 years. I do know that with hotter materials, cracks grow faster, so, you know, it's unclear to me, you know, how long it can actually take.
What is the NRC's contingency plan when one of these really crack and it really just breaks open? Because as they start to crack, they can't, my understanding from our discussions is that they can't just move these things once they've started cracking, and there's no real way to truly fix it. So what's the contingency plan when it really breaks through?
I'm still waiting for an honest answer from the NRC and Southern California Edison, because so far I've got none. They have none.
No evacuation plan or places to put people, or like, this is what's going to happen. We know this is coming in 10 to 15 years. So
no, you know what they're doing instead. Areva makes both thin and thick wall. They make thin wall canisters that they sell to the U.S. and then for their customers that care more about safety, which is pretty much most places except us, they use thick wall casts that don't have these issues, are fully inspectable inside and out, continuous radiation monitoring, continuous monitoring of pressure change to catch things before they leak, not after. So, and they have provisions to deal with maintenance. You know, they would start out giving answers like, oh, well, if we have a leak, we're going to have a portable hot cell brought to the site so that we can put it in a new container. And I researched that. There is no such thing available. I've got a transcript from another government agency where Oak Ridge said they had one facility in the country that would have been big enough to move one canister to another, move fuel from one to another, but they tore that down. It was called the TAN facility in Oak Ridge. And then they also discussed portable hot cells. Well, you know, it's not really feasible to have a portable hot cell that big as we would need. So that idea has been abandoned too, you know. So I got all this information, brought it to the next meeting we had with Southern California Edison. So now they don't say that anymore. So now they try and come up with another excuse, and they'll say, "Oh, well, if we have a canister leak, we'll put it in some kind of a thick cast." So then I do my research, contact the NRC. I deal with the director of the division that approves all this stuff, Director of Spent Fuel Management. And I said, "I can't find any information about a thick wall metal cast that's designed to hold a leaking canister." And he says,
"Did
well, that's
you
there
email him directly, or did you call his office?"
I don't remember. I think I may have. I don't remember. I probably emailed him. That's normally what I do, but I don't remember.
Okay.
But he says there is no such thing. I'd have to check my emails and see if that was an email. But he says there is no such thing. That's why you're not finding it. And then he said no vendor has submitted an application for even such a container approved for that purpose. Okay, so this is another BS, you know, story they're putting out to people. This is
yes,
what they tell.
Why do they continue to do this? This is my point. You've been
because
dealing
they
with
don't have, because they don't have the truth on their side. And it's all about the money, and it's all about unsubstantiated hope that nothing's going to go wrong.
Okay, so then maybe you can answer this one. This is a big question I have. Why are people who work in the nuclear industry considered whistleblowers when they just mention safety concerns? Like, we need to be, like, this is what you're doing. You're treating these people like they're rational partners in this. And you email them back, and they talk to you, and you provide them information, and then they push back. And yet, when a person who works there speaks out about something, they get demoted and put in the dungeon. They don't get fired right away, but they get placed in a place where they do no work all day long. I mean, these stories are not unheard of.
Well, you know, I intervened in the California Public Utility Commission proceeding where Edison wanted money to buy more of these inferior thin wall canister systems. And so I intervened. That was a very painful experience. It's not something I enjoyed, but I did it. And I tried to find a material engineer, because this is really a material engineering issue more than anything. But I tried to find a material engineer, any kind of engineer that had the credentials, because I'm an IT manager. I'm a systems designer, systems analyst. That's my, you know, I design mission critical systems. But I'm not an engineer, and I don't pretend to be one. But everything I have, all my statements are from engineers. They're from documents written by credible engineers, okay? And I could not find a material engineer willing to speak up. A lot of times they didn't know. One of them told me, "Are you kidding me? They're using thin wall stainless steel by the ocean? That's insane." He had no idea they were doing that. He worked on Yucca Mountain looking for containers that would be suitable Yucca Mountain, but he had no idea that temporary storage was this. And he wanted me to come to some corrosion meeting or annual corrosion meeting and tell other people and all of this. And so I thought he would make a good witness for this Public Utility Commission legal proceeding I had got into. And then all of a sudden, he just wasn't well enough to get involved. And anyway, I have suspicions for that Holtec, who is the manufacturer of a lot of these thin wall canisters. You know, I have suspicions that he got to him, but I can't prove that.
What does that mean, he got to him? Threatened him with his job?
The only thing I can say is that this person ended up, that this engineer that I had found ended up subsequently teaching a class at University of Pennsylvania on material corrosion. I actually watched it online. And that is Holtec's, Dr. Singh, the president of the company. That's his alma mater and who he gives lots of money to, one of the key institutions he gives lots of money to. So it was just a coincidence there. Okay, that's all I have there. But I do have another material engineer that has lots of great credentials. And he was not aware they were using these thin wall canisters, and I was sending him information. I sent him information about the Cobourg nuclear plant that had a tank that the NRC considers comparable to these thin wall canisters. It didn't hold nuclear fuel, but they said this has the same vulnerabilities. That one leaked in 17 years with cracks longer than the thickness of most of our canisters. And so I had this conversation going back and forth, you know, on the phone and email. And then one day he says to me, he says, Donna, you know, I've done work for Holtec in the past, and I plan to do some for them in the future.
So sometime in the future.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically, if you're a material engineer and you want to work in your career field, you take on, whether it's nuclear, I'm sure probably the same thing's true in other energy fields and other areas, you know, you basically can get blackballed.
Yes, but therein, this is where I get really, like, my ire gets up, because we're talking about, we're living in the so-called free trade market, where this is the basis of how they do all these things. We're getting the best deal for the best price within the system. But when people cannot speak up about safety issues without fear of retribution, that it completely destroys all participation. I mean, it really undermines everything.
That's why we have to get involved. I thought before I got involved in this, I was naive. You know, as a systems analyst, you know, we're taught and we learn never assume, because assume makes a, you know, of you and me.
Mm-hmm.
But I assume that if you're running a nuclear plant, you would have the best employees, lots of redundancies, lots of backups, reward employees if they find problems.
Mm-hmm.
You would have a federal regulatory agency that was going to make sure they did the right thing and do their job, because the consequences are so horrendous. It wasn't even in my imagination that wouldn't be true, you know. And all of that I have learned through this process, that none of that is true. And in terms of a free market, are you kidding me? Government subsidies for all these energy companies and, you know, whatever else.
What do you think HR 3053 is about, Donna? That's fundamentally what 3053 is about. This is how it's hopping through Congress.
Yeah, 3053. Before we get to that, I know we're going to run out of time, but I wanted to mention.
We have about 15 minutes left.
Yeah, okay. I wanted to mention a couple other things that happened at the Diablo Canyon meeting, because they're significant.
Okay.
PG&E told the members of this committee the reason they did not choose the thick wall cast was because they were too heavy for transport. He said that the Holtec, the ones that they use, the Holtec canisters that they use, that the transport casts are about 125 tons. So when I got up there, I said, that is not true. It's actually the opposite. The Holtec transport casts that hold these thin wall canisters, they're like 225 tons. The thick wall cast designed for storage and transport, they're in the 125-ton range. So PG&E selected the thin wall canisters because transport was not so heavy. They made the wrong decision. So I basically, and then he tried to claim that, oh, well, Europe uses the thick wall cast because they reprocess and they have to be able to open them up. And then I got up there and I said, Germany does not reprocess. They used to. They quit reprocessing. They've been using these thick wall casts for over 40 years. There's lots of others too, and they've had no problems with them. They have operating experience. They, you know, Japan has them. They're able to open them up to make sure everything's okay inside, so that they're holding up. Like, there's baskets inside, which is another issue we don't have time for. I was at a two-day NRC meeting. I've got more information about these baskets inside of the canisters that actually hold these bundles of fuel rods are called assemblies, hold these assemblies in separate basket holes. So there's some problems with the baskets, but ours are, all these thermal canisters are welded shut, so they have no clue what's going on inside. So anyway, if you watch that video presentation, you'll see where I was able to call PG&E on all their BS, and I think I established credibility with the members that were there. So I'm hoping a follow-up will help on that. There is a tendency for nuclear engineers to believe, you know, all this, what is really propaganda, and make assumptions. I was able to bust a lot of assumptions that these engineers had sitting there, but, you know, it's just, it's just one more, you know, attempt to get the truth out, but we need a lot more. So
you were asking me something. This is my thing with these people that have been brainwashed. You're really going against their brainwashing. They really are like Stockholm Syndrome people. Because if they choose to speak out and believe the truth, then they get severely punished by their captors.
Well, I know one engineer that he basically had, you know, he basically became a whistleblower. I'm still in touch with him, a material engineer. He became a whistleblower, and he could no longer get a job in his career field, but he had to speak up, and he ended up just choosing another career field, you know. It is what it is. I mean, the world is how it is, and rather than just saying, well, the world should be different, we have to go, okay, this is how the world is. Let's just look at it clearly. Let's just understand how the world works. So then we can start focusing on how do we get our way in this environment. But because if you don't go there, you're never going to take that next step and say, what are our options to, you know,
how do we get our way? That's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, it's really, you know.
It's not about having them take on and understand a different point of view. It's more about just asserting what you want to have.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's really.
Well, yeah. Okay, then. Well, you've been very successful at doing this, so I'm taking your lead. This is a great way. This is why it's valuable. I appreciate your conversation here because these are big questions, and how do we move through this? Because we're dealing with a huge block of, in my view, captives, and they're all pushing back against what is rational and sane. Because,
well, you know, but in any problem, I like to look for the opportunity. So right now, there's a House bill, H.R. 3053. It's called the Shimkus bill. It's promising people that, and it's promising elected officials in the public, oh, well, we pass this bill, then we can take all your nuclear waste away from you, you know, unless you happen to live in New Mexico or Texas or maybe Nevada, because, you know, that's kind of what they're not saying that in the bill about New Mexico and Texas, but, you know, people know those are the ones that have applications pending at the NRC. So it promises this, but it doesn't deliver on that promise. So at sanitoryfreesafety.org, you will, right at the top of the homepage, since this is a hot issue, I've got the reasons that is a bad bill, but the information that our elected officials were given was propaganda. They weren't given the truth about what's in this bill, so there are some tools there. One of the tough things for elected officials, if they vote against this bill, their opponents are going to say, well, he didn't vote for the bill that was going to get rid of your waste. You know, I mean, so you have that issue. In any case, this is an opportunity to educate the elected officials. But before you can do that, you need to get more educated. And unfortunately, there's no magic people out here. There's no that are on this particular issue that are out there making this their key issue. So I'm working on that too, but you know they're more busy on dealing with, you know, problems with reactors and other things. There's a lot of people that are out. There's over 49 organizations and growing that are opposed to this bill for various reasons.
That's good.
But they do. And I have a copy of their letter opposing that. So I have their reasons, and then there's also additional reasons. This bill will give money that actually doesn't even exist. There's supposed to be a nuclear waste fund in there for a permanent repository. That money has most of it's already been borrowed to use for other things. So before any money will be there to use, it has to be allocated by Congress. So then we're at the mercy of them giving you enough money to manage waste. It eliminates all the safety requirements out of the law. The law has safety requirements that you must be able to monitor and retrieve this fuel, you know, and they're taking that out of the law. And I called the bill author. I said, why are you removing the safety requirements out of the law?
Who needs that part?
Yeah. I said, why are you removing the safety requirements out of the law? And he says, oh, well, the NRC does such an excellent job. We don't need all these laws, you know. I mean, it's just nutso. And it takes away.
It's not nuts. It's really, to be honest, it's murderous. They cannot do this.
Yeah. Well, you're having Democrats and Republican elected officials supporting this bill.
I know.
You know, in the House. But we have to use this as an opportunity to educate the elected officials and the public on what's going on. And so, you know, there are a number of tools there. So even if you don't win a particular battle, it's about, you know, winning the war and not just the battle. So you don't give up. If you don't make progress the first time, you go, okay, what do I need to do different? Or you don't give up, you know. One approach doesn't work.
Here we are at 8 o'clock in the morning talking about it, you know, so there you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is an opportunity. I mean, they're paying attention to this issue because they have to vote. So that's an opportunity to educate them, give them information. They might not get it the first time around, but you keep going and it gets through. I mean, we started working with like city councils and educating them because they represent our communities also. And they didn't know any of these things. And I've had elected officials, local elected officials, send emails to the head of San Onofre and say, why are you using thin canisters instead of thick casks? And that's just the question we want them asking. You know, why are you doing this? They don't have a good answer.
What happens when they give a bad answer?
That's a good question. One of the things I try and do is find out what kind of answers they're giving so that I can include in my the handouts that I put out there for everyone, so I can give you the counters to that. So just like this new thing with PG&E where they claimed, oh, well, the thick ones are too heavy, and that's BS, you know. So anyway, I need to work on a myth sheet, but they really have no good answers. The scary.
Was it because of money? Was one cheaper than another, or there was a preferred?
They were cheap is the wrong word. You know, these are multi-million dollars each unit. You know, the unit, you have the thin canister, the labor, and then the concrete overpass or cast, each unit, that's up to like $4 million now almost for just one unit. But it was less expensive than the thick cast. But that's only if you're talking short term. If you're talking more than, you know, 15, 20, 25 years, then the thick ones will be cheaper because you don't have the cracking problem and they're going to hold up longer. I mean, the stuff we're putting in there has to basically be maintained to infinity, you know. That's an exaggeration, but it might as well be considering how long, you know, we've existed. So we're talking short-term thinking in terms of cost. But, you know, and I'm So they really are less expensive if you consider past their short lifespan. Costs have changed. There's two types of thick wall cast. There's a ductile cast iron and then a forged steel type used in Fukushima. There's different costs. So these companies won't even allow them to bid. Okay, that's
what really blows me away is that they know they're putting in containers that have a limited lifespan, and yet a very short lifespan. You know, with these ones that crack, the 3/8-inch ones that we're using in our country.
Well, They're not 3/8-inch. The majority are a half inch, and then there's a couple that are 5/8 of an inch. The 3/8-inch, I think that's what the Defense Waste in Hanford is storing. I think that's about 3/8 of an inch there.
So this is the thing. What's the contingency plan? Like,
there is no contingency plan.
I mean, what are they going to do?
I'll tell you what they're going to do. I managed to get a copy of a slide presentation, the Areva vendor for their thin cast, where they're asking to not have to measure peak radiation levels from the outlet air vent. Okay, they only want to measure radiation levels, report radiation levels, or peak radiation levels from the inlet vent. Their plan is to hide the leaks, but they'll be able to say they comply with all NRC safety requirements if the NRC approves this, which they probably will.
If they're going to continue to ignore
That's where I get all the information to use again. Now, this is the other thing: the working level people at the NRC, they do a lot of good work. They have, when Holtec wanted a transport cask approved, the NRC engineers, working level, asked really good questions. You have to prove that there are no partial cracks in these canisters before you can transport them. You have to prove that the fuel inside has not become damaged before you transport. They have all the right things. And at some point, it apparently got overridden, which the only one that could override them would be management. And they said, we're just going to pretend there's cracks when they're 5 years old. And then if they're over than 5 years old, then you only need to look for surface defects as best you can in 20% of the ones you want to ship. Surface defects don't find cracks, okay? So they basically are ignoring and not following the intent and ignoring their own regulations. That's what's going on. But, you know, we need the information. Now, that bill, 3053, it allows the DOE to take the waste and make contracts with private companies. They call them MRS agreements.
We have 45
seconds. Once they have these MRS agreements, there's a part in the bill that says that no one has any oversight, input, or transparency at that point forward.
Wow.
So they want to take away our democracy. They want to take away our rights.
Let's end there and let's make this people understand. This is about undoing our democracy. This is slipping into authoritarianism, and we really need to stand up to it. Go to Donna Gilmore's page. Please get active. Do more than put your courage feet on. Take action, because the time is now. If we want our future to even look like some semblance of liberty and freedom and participation, put your courage feet on. Take action. Thanks, Donna.